has been vaccinated and unloused and is passed as vermin-free. This date, September 23rd, 1922, disinfection, maritime Piraeus. Literate, married to only one person, albeit a sibling, democratically inclined, mentally stable, and authoritatively deloused, my grandparents saw no reason why they would have trouble getting through. They each had the requisite $25 apiece. They also had a sponsor, their cousin, Somalina. Just the year before, the Quota Act had reduced the annual numbers of Southern and Eastern European immigrants from 783,000 to 155,000. It was nearly impossible to get into the country without either a sponsor or stunning professional recommendations. To help their own chances, Lefty put away his French phrase book and began memorizing four lines of the King James New Testament. The Julia was full of inside sources familiar with the English literacy test. Different nationalities were asked to translate different bits of scripture. For Greeks, it was Matthew 19:12. For there are some eunuchs which were so born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men, and there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Eunuchs, Desdemona quailed. Who told you this? This is a passage from the Bible. What Bible? Not the Greek Bible. Go ask somebody else what's on that test. But Lefty showed her the Greek at the top of the card and the English below. He repeated the passage word by word, making her memorize it whether or not she understood it. We didn't have enough eunuchs in Turkey? Now we have to talk about them at Ellis Island? The Americans let in everyone, Lefty joked. Eunuchs included. They should let us speak Greek if they're so accepting, Desdemona grumbled. Summer was abandoning the ocean. One night it grew too cold in the lifeboat to crack the corset's combination. Instead, they huddled under blankets talking. "Is Somalina meeting us in New York?" Desdemona asked. "No. We have to take a train to Detroit. Why can't she meet us?" "Oh, it's too far." "Just as well. She wouldn't be on time anyway." The ceaseless sea wind made the tarp's edges flap. Frost formed on the lifeboat's gunwales. They could see the top of the Julia smokestack, the smoke itself discernible only as a starless patch of night sky. Though they didn't know it, that striped, canted smokestack was already informing them about their new home. It was whispering about River Rouge and the Uniroyal plant and the seven sisters and two brothers, but they didn't listen. They wrinkled up their noses and ducked down in the lifeboat away from the smoke. And if the smell of industry didn't insist on entering my story already, if Desdemona and Lefty, who grew up on a pine-scented mountain and who could never get used to the polluted air of Detroit, hadn't ducked down in the lifeboat, then they might have detected a new aroma wafting in on the brisk sea air, a humid odor of mud and wet bark. Land. New York. America. What are we going to tell Somalina about us? She'll understand. Will she keep quiet? There are a few things she'd rather her husband didn't know about her.
Oh, you mean Helen?
I didn't say a thing, said Lefty.
They fell asleep after that, waking to sunlight and a face staring down at them.
Did you have a good sleep? Captain Contulus said. Maybe I could get you a blanket.
I'm sorry, Lefty said. We won't do it again.
You won't get the chance, said the captain, and to prove his point, pulled the lifeboat's tarp completely away.
Desdemona and Lefty sat up. In the distance, lit by the rising sun, was the skyline of New York. It wasn't the right shape for a city. No domes, no minarets, and it took them a minute to process the tall geometric forms. Mist curled off the bay. A million pink window panes glittered. Closer, crowned with her own sun rays and dressed like a classical Greek, the Statue of Liberty welcomed them.
How do you like that? Captain Contulus asked.
I've seen enough torches to last the rest of my life, said Lefty. But Desdemona, for once, was more optimistic. At least it's a woman, she said. Maybe here people won't be killing each other every single day.
Book 2. Henry Ford's English Language Melting Pot. Everyone who builds a factory builds a temple. Calvin Coolidge. Detroit was always made of wheels. Long before the Big Three and the nickname Motor City, before the auto factories and the freighters and the pink chemical knights, before anyone had necked in a Thunderbird or spooned in a Model T, previous to the day a young Henry Ford knocked down his workshop wall because, in devising his quadricycle, he thought of everything but how to get the damn thing out. And nearly a century prior to the cold March night in 1896, when Charles King, Tiller, steered his horseless carriage down St. Antoine, along Jefferson, and up Woodward Avenue, where the two-stroke engine promptly quit, way, way back when the city was just a piece of stolen Indian land located on the strait, from which it got its name, a fort fought over by the British and French until, wearing them out, it fell into the hands of the Americans. Way back then, before cars and clover leaves, Detroit was made of wheels. I am 9 years old and holding my father's meaty, sweaty hand. We are standing at a window on the top floor of the Pontchartrain Hotel. I've come downtown for our annual lunch date. I'm wearing a mini skirt and fuchsia tights. A white patent leather purse hangs on a long strap from my shoulder. The fogged window has spots on it. We are way up high. I am going to order shrimp scampi in a minute. The reason for my father's hand perspiration? He's afraid of heights. 2 days ago, when he offered to take me wherever I wanted, I called out in my piping voice, "Top of the punch!" High above the city, amid the business lunchers and power brokers, was where I wanted to be. And Milton had been true to his promise. Despite racing pulse, he has allowed the maitre d' to give us a table next to the window, so that now here we are. As a tuxedoed waiter pulls out my chair and my father, too frightened to sit, begins a history lesson instead. What's the reason for studying history? To understand the present or avoid it? Milton, olive complexion turning a shade pale, only says,
"Look, see the wheel?"
And now I squint, oblivious at 9 to the prospect of crow's feet. I gaze out over downtown, down to the streets where my father is indicating, though not looking, and there it is, half a hubcap of City Plaza, with the spokes of Bagley, Washington, Woodward, Broadway, and Madison radiating from it. That's all that remains of the famous Woodward Plan, drawn up in 1807 by the hard-drinking eponymous judge. 2 years earlier, in 1805, the city had burned to the ground. The timber houses and ribbon farms of the settlement, founded by Cadillac in 1701, going up in the span of 3 hours. And in 1969, with my sharp vision, I can read the traces of that fire on the city's flag, a half mile away in Grand Circus Park. Speramus meliora resurgit cineribus. We hope for better things, it will rise from the ashes. Judge Woodward envisioned the new Detroit as an urban Arcadia of interlocking hexagons. Each wheel was to be separate yet united, in accordance with the young nation's federalism, as well as classically symmetrical in accordance with Jeffersonian aesthetics. This dream never quite came to be. Planning is for the world's great cities, for Paris, London, and Rome, for cities dedicated, at some level, to culture. Detroit, on the other hand, was an American city, and therefore dedicated to money. And so design had given way to expediency. Since 1818, the city had spread out along the river, warehouse by warehouse, factory by factory. Judge Woodward's wheels had been squashed, bisected, pressed into the usual rectangles. Or seen another way, from a rooftop restaurant, the wheels hadn't vanished at all. They'd only changed form. By 1900, Detroit was the leading manufacturer of carriages and wagons. By 1922, when my grandparents arrived, Detroit made other spinning things too,
marine engines, bicycles, hand-rolled cigars, and yes, finally, cars. All this was visible from the train. Approaching along the shore of the Detroit River, Lefty and Desdemona watched their new home take shape. They saw farmland give way to fenced lots and cobblestone streets. The sky darkened with smoke. Buildings flew by, brick warehouses painted in pragmatic Bookman white. Wright and K. Company, J.H. Black and Sons, Detroit Stove Works. Out on the water, squat, tar-colored barges dragged along, and people popped up on the streets, workmen in grimy overalls, clerks thumbing suspenders, the signs of eateries and boarding houses appearing next. We serve Stroh's Temperance Beer. Make this your home. Meals, 15 cents. As these new sights flooded my grandparents' brains, they jostled with images from the day before. Ellis Island, rising like a doge's palace on the water, the baggage room stacked to the ceiling with luggage. They'd been herded up a stairway to the registry room. Pinned with numbers from the Julia's manifest, they'd filed past a line of health inspectors, who looked in their eyes and ears, rubbed their scalps, and flipped their eyelids inside out with button hooks. One doctor, noticing inflammation under Dr. Philibosian's eyelids, had stopped the examination and chalked an X on his coat. He was led out of line. My grandparents hadn't seen him again. Oh, he must have caught something on the boat, Desdemona said, or his eyes were red from all that crying. Meanwhile, chalk continued to do its work all around them. It marked a PG on the belly of a pregnant woman. It scrawled an H over an old man's failing heart. It diagnosed the C of conjunctivitis, the F of phavus, and the T of trachoma. But no matter how well-trained, medical eyes couldn't spot a recessive mutation hiding out on a fifth chromosome. Fingers couldn't feel it. Button hooks couldn't bring it to light. Now on the train, my grandparents were tagged, not with manifest numbers, but with destination cards. To the conductor, please show bearer where to change and where to get off. As this person does not speak English, bearer is bound to Grand Trunk Station, Detroit. They sat next to each other in unreserved seats. Lefty faced the window, looking out with excitement. Desdemona stared down at her silkworm box. Her cheeks crimson with the shame and fury she'd been suffering for the last 36 hours. That's the last time anyone cuts my hair, she said. You look fine, said Lefty, not looking. You look like an Americanada. I don't want to look like an Americanada. In the concessions area at Ellis Island, Lefty had cajoled Desdemona to step into a tent run by the YWCA. She'd gone in, shawled and kerchiefed, and had emerged 15 minutes later in a drop-waisted dress and a floppy hat shaped like a chamber pot. Rage flamed beneath her new face powder. As part of the makeover, the YWCA ladies had cut off Desdemona's immigrant braids. Obsessively, in the way a person worries, a rip deep in a pocket, she now reached up under the floppy hat to feel her denuded scalp for the 30th or 40th time. That's the last haircut, she said again. She was true to this vow. From that day on, Desdemona grew her hair out like Lady Godiva, keeping it under a net in an enormous mass and washing it every Friday. And only after Lefty died did she ever cut it, giving it to Sophie Sassoon, who sold it for $250 to a wig maker who made 5 separate wigs out of it, one of which, she claimed, was later bought by Betty Ford, post-White House and rehab, so that we got to see it on television once during Richard Nixon's funeral. My grandmother's hair sitting on the ex-president's wife's head. But there was another reason for my grandmother's unhappiness. She opened the silkworm box in her lap. Inside were her 2 braids, still tied with the ribbons of mourning. But otherwise the box was empty. After carrying her silkworm eggs all the way from Vitinios, Desdemona had been forced to dump them out at Ellis Island. Silkworm eggs appeared on a list of parasites. Lefty remained glued to the window. All the way from Hoboken, he'd gazed out at the marvelous sights. Electric trams pulling pink faces up Albany's hills, factories glowing like volcanoes in the Buffalo night. Once, waking as the train pulled through a city at dawn, Lefty had mistaken a pillared bank for the Parthenon and thought he was in Athens again. Now the Detroit River sped past and the city loomed. Lefty stared out at the motor cars parked like giant beetles at the curbsides. Smokestacks rose everywhere, cannons bombarding the atmosphere. There were red brick stacks and tall silver ones, stacks in regimental rows or all alone, puffing meditatively away, a forest of smokestacks that dimmed the sunlight and then, all of a sudden, blocked it out completely. Everything went black. They'd entered the train station. Grand Trunk Station, now a ruin of spectacular dimensions, was then the city's attempt to one-up New York. Its base was a mammoth marble neoclassical museum complete with Corinthian pillars and carved entablature. From this temple rose a 13-story office building. Lefty, who'd been observing all the ways Greece had been handed down to America, arrived now at where the transmission stopped. In other words, the future. He stepped off to meet it. Desdemona, having no alternative, followed. But just imagine it in those days. Grand Trunk! Telephones in 100 shipping offices ringing away, still a relatively new sound, and merchandise being sent east and west, passengers arriving and departing, having coffee in the palm quarter, getting their shoes shined, the wing tips of banking, the cap toes of parts supply, the saddle shoes of rum running. Grand Trunk, with its vaulted ceilings of Guastavino tilework, its chandeliers, its floors of Welsh quarry stone. There was a six-chair barbershop where civic leaders were mummified in hot towels and bathtubs for rent, and elevator banks lit by translucent egg-shaped marble lamps. Leaving Desdemona behind a pillar, Lefty searched through the mob in the station for the cousin who was meeting their train. Somalino Zismo, nay, Papadiamandopoulos, was my grandparents' cousin, and hence my first cousin twice removed. I knew her as a colorful older woman, Somalina of the precarious cigarette ash, Somalino of the indigo bathwater, Somalino of the Theosophical Society brunches. She wore satin gloves up to the elbow and mothered a long line of smelly dachshunds with tear-stained eyes. Footstools populated her house, allowing the short-legged creatures access to sofas and chaise lounges. In 1922, however, Somalina was only 28. Picking her out of the crowded Grand Trunk is as difficult for me as identifying guests in my parents' wedding album, where all the faces wear the disguise of youth. Lefty had a different problem. He paced the concourse, looking for the cousin he'd grown up with. A sharp-nosed girl with the grinning mouth of a comedy mask. Sun slanted in from the skylights above. He squinted, examining the passing women, until finally she called out to him, "Over here, cousin! Don't you recognize me? I'm the irresistible one. Lena, is that you? I'm not in the village anymore." In the 5 years since leaving Turkey, Somalina had managed to erase just about everything identifiably Greek about her, from her hair, which she dyed to a rich chestnut and now wore bobbed and marcelled, to her accent, which had migrated far enough west to sound vaguely European, to her reading material, Collier's, Harper's, to her favorite foods, lobster thermidor, peanut butter, and finally to her clothes. She wore a short green flapper dress fringed at the hemline. Her shoes were a matching green satin with sequined toes and delicate ankle straps. A black feather boa was wrapped around her shoulders, and on her head was a cloche hat that dangled onyx pendants over her plucked eyebrows. For the next few seconds, she gave Lefty the full benefit of her sleek American pose. But it was still Lena inside there, under the cloche, and soon her Greek enthusiasm bubbled out. She spread her arms wide. "Kiss me, hello, cousin!" They embraced. Lena pressed a rouged cheek against his neck. Then she pulled back to examine him, and dissolving into laughter, cupped her hand over his nose. Oh, it's still you. I'd know this nose anywhere. Her laugh completed its follow-through as her shoulders went up and down, and then she was on to the next thing. So, where is she? Where is this new bride of yours? Your telegram didn't even give a name. What? Is she hiding? She's in the bathroom. She must be a beauty. You got married fast enough. Which did you do first? Introduce yourself or propose? I think I proposed. What does she look like? She looks like you. Oh, darling, not that good, surely. Sormelita brought her cigarette holder to her lips and inhaled, scanning the crowd. Oh, poor Desdemona. Her brother falls in love and leaves her behind in New York. How is she?
She's fine.
Why didn't she come with you? She's not jealous of your new wife, is she?
No, nothing like that.
She clutched his arms. We read about the fire. Terrible. I was so worried until I got your letter. The Turks started it. I know it. Of course, my husband doesn't agree.
He doesn't.
One suggestion. Since you'll be living with us, don't talk politics with my husband.
All right.
And the village? Sormelina inquired.
Everybody left the Horio, Lena. There's nothing now. If I didn't hate that place, maybe I'd shed 2 tears.
Lena, there's something I have to explain to you. But Sormelina was looking away, tapping her foot. Maybe she fell in.
Something about Desdemona and me.
Yes?
My wife, Desdemona.
Was I right? They don't get along?
No! Desdemona, my wife.
Yes?
Same person.
He gave the signal. Desdemona stepped from behind the pillar. Hello, Lena, my grandmother said. We're married. Don't tell.
And that was how it came out. For the next to last time. Blurted out by my Yaya. Beneath the echoing roof of Grand Trunk toward Sormelina's cloche-covered ears. The confession hovered in the air a moment before floating away with the smoke rising from her cigarette. Desdemona took her husband's arm.
My grandparents had every reason to believe that Sormelina would keep their secret.
She'd come to America with a secret of her own, a secret that would be guarded by our family until Sormelina died in 1979, whereupon, like everyone's secrets, it was posthumously declassified, so that people began to speak of Sormelina's girlfriends. A secret kept, in other words, only by the loosest definition, so that now, as I get ready to leak the information myself, I feel only a slight twinge of filial guilt. Sormelina's secret, as Aunt Zo put it, Lena was one of those women they named the island after. As a girl in the Horio, Sormelina had been caught in compromising circumstances with a few female friends. Not many, she told me herself years later. 2 or 3. People think if you like girls, you like every single one. I was always picky, and there wasn't much to pick from. For a while, she'd struggled against her predisposition. I went to church. It didn't help. In those days, that was the best place to meet a girlfriend. In church, all of us praying to be different. When Sormelina was caught, not with another girl, but with a full-grown woman, a mother of 2 children, a scandal arose. Sormelina's parents tried to arrange her marriage, but found no takers. Husbands were hard enough to come by in Vithinios without the added liability of an uninterested, defective bride. Her father had then done what Greek fathers of unmarriageable girls did in those days. He wrote to America. The United States abounded with dollar bills, baseball sluggers, raccoon coats, diamond jewelry, and lonely immigrant bachelors. With a photograph of the prospective bride and a considerable dowry, her father had come up with one. Jimmy Zizmo, shortened from Zizimopoulos, had come to America in 1907 at the age of 30. The family didn't know much about him except that he was a hard bargainer. In a series of letters to Sormelina's father, Zizmo had negotiated the amount of the dowry in the formal language of a barrister, even going so far as to demand a bank check before the wedding day.
The photograph Sir Molina received showed a tall, handsome man with a virile mustache, holding a pistol in one hand and a bottle of liquor in the other. When she stepped off the train at Grand Trunk 2 months later, however, the short man who greeted her was clean-shaven with a sour expression and a laborer's dark complexion. Such a discrepancy might have disappointed a normal bride, but Sor Molina didn't care one way or another. Sor Molina had written often, describing her new life in America, but she concentrated on the new fashions or her Areola Junior, the radio she spent hours each day listening to, wearing earphones and manipulating the dial, stopping every so often to clean off the carbon dust that built up on the crystal. She never mentioned anything connected to what Desdemona referred to as the bed, and so her cousins were forced to read between the lines of those aerograms, trying to see in a description of a Sunday drive through Belle Isle whether the face of the husband at the wheel was happy or unsatisfied, or inferring from a passage about Sor Molina's latest hairstyle something called cootie garages, whether Zizmo was ever allowed to muss it up. This same Sor Molina, full of her own secrets, now took in her new co-conspirators.
Married? You mean sleeping together married?
Lefty managed.
Yes.
Sor Molina noticed her ash for the first time and flicked it. Just my luck. Soon as I leave the village, things get interesting. But Desdemona couldn't abide such irony. She grabbed Sor Molina's hands and pleaded, "You have to promise never to tell. We'll live, we'll die, and that will be the end of it."
"I won't tell. People can't even know I'm your cousin. I won't tell anyone."
"What about your husband?"
"He thinks I'm picking up my cousin and his new wife."
"You won't say anything to him?"
"That'll be easy," Lena laughed. "He doesn't listen to me."
Sor Molina insisted on getting a porter to carry their suitcases to the car, a black and tan Packard. She tipped him and climbed behind the wheel, attracting looks. A woman driving was still a scandalous sight in 1922. After resting her cigarette holder on the dashboard, she pulled out the choke, waited the requisite 5 seconds, and pressed the ignition button. The car's tin bonnet shuddered to life. The leather seats began to vibrate, and Desdemona took hold of her husband's arm. Up front, Sor Molina took off her satin-strap high heels to drive barefoot. She put the car into gear and, without checking traffic, lurched off down Michigan Avenue toward Cadillac Square. My grandparents' eyes glazed over at the sheer activity. Streetcars rumbling, bells clanging, and the monochrome traffic swerving in and out. In those days, downtown Detroit was filled with shoppers and businessmen. Outside Hudson's department store, the crowd was 10-thick, jostling to get in the newfangled revolving doors. Lena pointed out the sights. The Café Frontenac, the Family Theater, and the enormous electric signs. Ralston, Wait and Bond, Blackstone Mile, 10-cent cigar. Above, a 30-foot boy spread Meadow Gold butter on a 10-foot slice of bread. One building had a row of giant oil lamps over the entrance to promote a sale on until October 31st. It was all swirl and hubbub. Desdemona, lying against the back seat, already suffering the anxiety that modern conveniences would induce in her over the years, cars mainly, but toasters, too, lawn sprinklers, and escalators, while Lefty grinned and shook his head. Skyscrapers were going up everywhere, and movie palaces and hotels. The 20s saw the construction of nearly all Detroit's great buildings, the Penobscot Building and the Second Buell Building, colored like an Indian belt, the new Union Trust Building, the Cadillac Tower, the Fisher Building with its gilded roof. To my grandparents, Detroit was like one big Cosahan during cocoon season. What they didn't see were the workers sleeping on the streets because of the housing shortage, and the ghetto just to the east, a 30-square-block area bounded by Leland, Macomb, Hastings, and Brush Streets, teeming with the city's African-Americans who weren't allowed to live anywhere else. They didn't see, in short, the seeds of the city's destruction. Its second destruction, because they were part of it too, all these people coming from everywhere to cash in on Henry Ford's $5-a-day promise. The east side of Detroit was a quiet neighborhood of single-family homes shaded by cathedral elms. The house on Hurlbut Street Lena drove them to was a modest two-story building of root beer-colored brick. My parents gaped at it from the car, unable to move, until suddenly the front door opened and someone stepped out. Jimmy Zismo was so many things, I don't know where to begin. Amateur herbalist, anti-suffragist, big game hunter, ex-con, drug pusher, teetotaler, take your pick. He was 45 years old, nearly twice as old as his wife. Standing on the dim porch, he wore an inexpensive suit and a shirt with a pointy collar that had lost most of its starch. His frizzy black hair gave him the wild look of the bachelor he'd been for so many years, and this impression was heightened by his face, which was rumpled like an unmade bed. His eyebrows, however, were as seductively arch as a Notch girl's, his eyelashes so thick he might have been wearing mascara. But my grandmother didn't notice any of that. She was fixated on something else. "An Arab?" Desdemona asked as soon as she was alone with her cousin in the kitchen. "Is that why you didn't tell us about him in your letters?" "He's not an Arab. He's from the Black Sea."
"This is the Zala," Zismo was meanwhile explaining to Lefty as he showed him around the house.
"Pontian!" Desdemona gasped with horror while also examining the icebox. "He's not Muslim, is he?"
"Not everybody from the Pontus converted," Lisa scoffed. "What do you think? A Greek takes a swim in the Black Sea and turns into a Muslim?"
"But does he have Turkish blood?" She lowered her voice.
"Is that why he's so dark?"
"I don't know, and I don't care."
"You're free to stay as long as you like." Zismo was now leading Lefty upstairs. "But there are a few house rules. First, I'm a vegetarian. If your wife wants to cook meat, she has to use separate pots and dishes. Also, no whiskey. Do you drink?"
"Sometimes."
"No drinking. Go to a speakeasy if you want to drink. I don't want any trouble with the police. Now about the rent. You just got married."
"Yes."
"What kind of dowry did you get?"
"Dowry?"
"Yes, how much?"
"But did you know he was so old?" Desdemona whispered downstairs as she inspected the oven.
"At least he's not my brother."
"Quiet! Don't even choke."
"I didn't get a dowry," answered Lefty. "We met on the boat over." "No dowry?" Zismo stopped on the stairs to look back at Lefty with astonishment. "Why did you get married, then?"
"We fell in love," Lefty said. He'd never announced it to a stranger before, and it made him feel happy and frightened all at once.
"If you don't get paid, don't get married," Zismo said. "That's why I waited so long. I was holding out for the right price." He winked.
"Lena mentioned you have your own business now," Lefty said with sudden interest, following Zismo into the bathroom. "What kind of business is it?"
"Me? I'm an importer." "I don't know of what," Sormelina answered in the kitchen. "An importer! All I know is he brings home money."
"But how can you marry somebody you don't know anything about?"
"To get out of that country, Des, I would have married a cripple."
"I have some experience with importing," Lefty managed to get in as Zismo demonstrated the plumbing. "Back in Bursa, in the silk industry."
"Your portion of the rent is $20. Zismo didn't take the hint. He pulled the chain, unleashing a flood of water. "As far as I'm concerned," Lena was continuing downstairs, "when it comes to husbands, the older the better." She opened the pantry door. "A young husband would be after me all the time. It would be too much of a strain."
"Shame on you, Lena." But Desdemona was laughing now, despite herself. It was wonderful to see her old cousin again, a little piece of Vithinio still intact. The dark pantry, full of figs, almonds, walnuts, halva, and dried apricots, made her feel better, too. "But where can I get the rent?" Lefty finally blurted out as they headed back downstairs. "I don't have any money left. Where can I work?"
"Not a problem," Zismo waved his hand. "I'll speak to a few people."
They came through the sala again. Zismo stopped and looked significantly down.
"You haven't complimented my zebra skin rug."
"It's very nice."
"I brought it back from Africa, shot it myself."
"You've been to Africa?"
"I've been all over."
Like everybody else in town, they squeezed in together. Desdemona and Lefty slept in a bedroom directly above Zismo and Lena's. And the first few nights, my grandmother climbed out of bed to put her ear to the floor. "Nothing," she said. "I told you..."
Come back to bed, Lefty scolded. That's their business. What business? That's what I'm telling you. They aren't having any business.
While in the bedroom below, Zizmo was discussing the new boarders upstairs.
What a romantic. Meets a girl on the boat and marries her. No dowry.
Some people marry for love. Marriage is for housekeeping and for children. Which reminds me. Please, Jimmy, not tonight.
Then when? 5 years we've been married and no children. You're always sick, tired, this, that.
Have you been taking the castor oil?
Yes.
And the magnesium?
Yes.
Good. We have to reduce your bile. If the mother has too much bile, the child will lack vigor and disobey his parents.
Good night, Kiri.
Good night, Kiria.
Before the week was out, all my grandparents' questions about Sormelina's marriage had been answered. Because of his age, Jimmy Zizmo treated his young bride more like a daughter than a wife. He was always telling her what she could and couldn't do, howling over the price and necklines of her outfits, telling her to go to bed, to get up, to speak, to keep silent. He refused to give her the car keys until she cajoled him with kisses and caresses, his nutritional quackery, even led him to monitor her regularity like a doctor, and some of their biggest fights came as a result of his interrogating Lena about her stools. As for sexual relations, they had happened, but not recently. For the last 5 months, Lena had complained of imaginary ailments, preferring her husband's herbal cures to his amatory attentions. Zizmo, in turn, harbored vaguely yogic beliefs about the mental benefits of semen retention, and so was disposed to wait until his wife's vitality returned. The house was sex-segregated like the houses in the Patrida, the old country. Men in the sala, women in the kitchen. Two spheres with separate concerns, duties, even, the evolutionary biologists might say, thought patterns. Lefty and Desdemona, accustomed to living in their own house, were forced to adapt to their new landlord's ways. Besides, my grandfather needed a job. In those days, there were a lot of car companies to work for. There was Chalmers, Metzger, Brush, Columbia, and Flanders. There was Hupp, Page, Hudson, Crit, Saxon, Liberty, Rickenbacker, and Dodge. Jimmy Zizmo, however, had connections at Ford.
I'm a supplier, he said.
Of what?
Assorted fuels.
They were in the Packard again, vibrating on thin tires. A light mist was falling. Lefty squinted through the fogged windshield. Little by little, as they approached along Michigan Avenue, he began to be aware of a monolith looming in the distance, a building like a gigantic church organ, pipes running into the sky. There was also a smell, the same smell that would drift up river years later to find me in my bed or in the field hockey goal. Like my own, similarly beaked nose at those times, my grandfather's nose went on alert. His nostrils flared. He inhaled. At first the smell was recognizable, part of the organic realm of bad eggs and manure, but after a few seconds the smell's chemical properties seared his nostrils, and he covered his nose with his handkerchief. Zizmo laughed.
Don't worry. You'll get used to it.
No, I won't.
You want to know the secret?
What?
Don't breathe.
When they reached the factory, Zizmo took him into the personnel department.
How long has he lived in Detroit? The manager asked.
6 months.
Can you verify that?
Zizmo now spoke in a low tone.
I could drop the necessary documents by your house.
The personnel manager looked both ways.
Old log cabin?
Only the best.
The chief jutted out his lower lip, examining my grandfather. How's his English?
Not as good as mine, but he learns fast.
He'll have to take the course and pass the test, otherwise he's out.
It's a deal. Now, if you'll write down your home address, we can schedule a delivery. Would Monday evening, say, around 8:30 be suitable?
Come around to the back door.
My grandfather's short employ at the Ford Motor Company marked the only time any Stephanides has ever worked in the automobile industry.
Instead of cars, we would become manufacturers of hamburger platters and Greek salads, industrialists of spanakopita and grilled cheese sandwiches, technocrats of rice pudding and banana cream pie. Our assembly line was the grill, our heavy machinery the soda fountain. Still, those 25 weeks gave us a personal connection to that massive, forbidding, awe-inspiring complex we saw from the highway, that controlled Vesuvius of chutes, tubes, ladders, catwalks, fire, and smoke, known like a plague or a monarch only by a color, the rouge. On the first day of work, Lefty came into the kitchen, modeling his new overalls. He spread his flannel-shirted arms and snapped his fingers, dancing in work boots, and Desdemona laughed and shut the kitchen door so as not to wake up Lena. Lefty ate his breakfast of prunes and yogurt, reading a Greek newspaper a few days old. Desdemona packed his Greek lunch of feta, olives, and bread in a new American container, a brown paper bag. At the back door, when he turned to kiss her, she stepped back, anxious that people might see, but then she remembered that they were married now. They lived in a place called Michigan, where the birds seemed to come in only one color and where no one knew them. Desdemona stepped forward again to meet her husband's lips, their first kiss in the great American outdoors, on the back porch near a cherry tree losing its leaves. A brief flare of happiness went off inside her and hung raining sparks until Lefty disappeared around the front of the house. My grandfather's good mood accompanied him all the way to the trolley stop. Other workers were already waiting, loose-kneed, smoking cigarettes and joking. Lefty noticed their metal lunch pails and, embarrassed by his paper sack, held it behind him. The streetcar showed up, first as a hum in the soles of his boots, then it appeared against the rising sun, Apollo's own chariot, only electrified. Inside, men stood in groups arranged by language. Faces scrubbed for work still had soot inside the ears, deep black. The streetcar sped off again. Soon the jovial mood dissipated, and the languages fell silent. Near downtown, a few blacks boarded the car, standing outside on the runners, holding on to the roof. And then the rouge appeared against the sky, rising out of the smoke it generated. At first, all that was visible was the tops of the 8 main smokestacks. Each gave birth to its own dark cloud. The clouds plumed upward and merged into a general pall that hung over the landscape, sending a shadow that ran along the trolley tracks. And Lefty understood that the men's silence was a recognition of this shadow, of its inevitable approach each morning. As it came on, the men turned their backs so that only Lefty saw the light leave the sky as the shadow enveloped the streetcar and the men's faces turned gray. And one of the Mavros on the runners spat blood onto the roadside. The smell seeped into the streetcar next. First, the bearable eggs and manure. Then the unbearable chemical taint. And Lefty looked at the other men to see if they registered it, but they didn't, though they continued to breathe. The doors opened, and they all filed out. Through the hanging smoke, Lefty saw other streetcars letting off other workers, hundreds and hundreds of gray figures, trudging across the paved courtyard toward the factory gates. Trucks were driving past, and Lefty let himself be taken along with the flow of the next shift, 50, 60, 70,000 men hurrying last cigarettes or getting in final words, because as they approached the factory, they'd begun to speak again, not because they had anything to say, but because beyond those doors, language wasn't allowed. The main building, a fortress of dark brick, was 7 stories high. The smokestacks, 17. Running off it were 2 chutes topped by water towers. These led to observation decks and to adjoining refineries studded with less impressive stacks. It was like a grove of trees, as if the Rouge's 8 main smokestacks had sown seeds to the wind, and now 10 or 20 or 50 smaller trunks were sprouting up in the infertile soil around the plant.
Lefty could see the train tracks now, the huge silos along the river, the giant spice box of coal, coke, and iron ore, and the catwalk stretching overhead like giant spiders. Before he was sucked in the door, he glimpsed a freighter and a bit of the river, French explorers named for its reddish color, long before the water turned orange from runoff or ever caught on fire. Historical fact. People stopped being human in 1913. That was the year Henry Ford put his cars on rollers and made his workers adopt the speed of the assembly line. At first, workers rebelled. They quit in droves, unable to accustom their bodies to the new pace of the age. Since then, however, the adaptation has been passed down. We've all inherited it to some degree so that we plug right into joysticks and remotes to repetitive motions of 100 kinds. But in 1922, it was still a new thing to be a machine. On the factory floor, my grandfather was trained for his job in 17 minutes. Part of the new production method's genius was its division of labor into unskilled tasks. That way you could hire anyone and fire anyone. The foreman showed Lefty how to take a bearing from the conveyor, grind it on a lathe, and replace it. Holding a stopwatch, he timed the new employee's attempts. Then, nodding once, he led Lefty to his position on the line. On the left stood a man named Wesbeke. On the right, a man named O'Malley. For a moment, they are three men waiting together. Then the whistle blows. Every 14 seconds, Wesbeke reams a bearing and Stefanides grinds a bearing and O'Malley attaches a bearing to a camshaft. This camshaft travels away on a conveyor, curling around the factory through its clouds of metal dust, its acid fogs, until another worker 50 yards on reaches up and removes the camshaft, fitting it onto the engine block. 20 seconds. Simultaneously, other men are unhooking parts from adjacent conveyors, the carburetor, the distributor, the intake manifold, and connecting them to the engine block. Above their bent heads, huge spindles pound steam-powered fists. No one says a word. Wesbeke reams a bearing, and Stefanides grinds a bearing, and O'Malley attaches a bearing to a camshaft. The camshaft circles around the floor until a hand reaches up to take it down and attach it to the engine block, growing increasingly eccentric now with swooshes of pipe and the plumage of fan blades. Wesbeke reams a bearing, and Stefanides grinds a bearing, and O'Malley attaches a bearing to a camshaft, while other workers screw in the air filter 17 seconds. And attach the starter motor, 26 seconds, and put on the flywheel, at which point the engine is finished and the last man sends it soaring away. Except that he isn't the last man. There are other men below hauling the engine in as a chassis rolls out to meet it. These men attach the engine to the transmission, 25 seconds. Wesbeke reams a bearing, and Stefanides grinds a bearing, and O'Malley attaches a bearing to a camshaft. My grandfather sees only the bearing in front of him, his hands removing it, grinding it, and putting it back as another appears. The conveyor over his head extends back to the men who stamp out the bearings and load ingots into the furnaces. It goes back to the foundry where the Negroes work, goggled against the infernal light and heat. They feed iron ore into the blast oven and pour molten steel into core molds from ladles. They pour at just the right rate, too quickly and the molds will explode, too slowly and the steel will harden. They can't stop even to pick the burning bits of metal from their arms. Sometimes the foreman does it? Sometimes not. The foundry is the deepest recess of the Rouge. It's molten core, but the line goes back farther than that. It extends outside to the hills of coal and coke. It goes to the river where freighters dock to unload the ore, at which point the line becomes the river itself, snaking up to the north woods until it reaches its source, which is the earth itself, the limestone and sandstone therein. And then the line leads back again, out of substrata, to river, to freighters, and finally to the cranes, shovels, and furnaces, where it is turned into molten steel and poured into molds, cooling and hardening into car parts. The gears, drive shafts, and fuel tanks of 1922 Model Ts.
where Speaky Reams are bearing and Stephanides grinds are bearing and O'Malley attaches a bearing to a camshaft. Above and behind at various angles, workers pack sand into core molds or hammer plugs into molds or put casting boxes into the cupola furnace. The line isn't a single line, but many diverging and intersecting. Other workers stamp out body parts, 50 seconds, bump them, 42 seconds, and weld the pieces together, 1 minute and 10 seconds. Where's Beaky Reams a bearing, and Stephanides grinds a bearing, and O'Malley attaches a bearing to a camshaft. The camshaft flies around the factory until a man unhooks it, attaches it to the engine block, growing eccentric now with fan blades, pipes, and spark plugs, and then the engine is finished. A man sends it dropping down onto a chassis, rolling out to meet it, as three other workers remove a car body from the oven, its black finish baked to a shine in which they can see their own faces, and they recognize themselves momentarily before they drop the body onto the chassis, rolling out to meet it. A man jumps into the front seat, 3 seconds, turns the ignition, 2 seconds, and drives the automobile away. By day, no words. By night, hundreds. Every evening at quitting time, my exhausted grandfather would come out of the factory and tramp across to an adjacent building housing the Ford English School. He sat in a desk with his workbook open in front of him. The desk felt as though it were vibrating across the floor at the line's 1.2 miles per hour. He looked up at the English alphabet in a frieze on the classroom walls. In rows around him, men sat over identical workbooks, hair stiff from dried sweat, eyes red from metal dust, hands raw. They recited with the obedience of choir boys. Employees should use plenty of soap and water in the home. Nothing makes for right living so much as cleanliness. Do not spit on the floor of the home. Do not allow any flies in the house. The most advanced people are the cleanest. Sometimes the English lessons continued on the job. 1 week, after a lecture by the foreman on increasing productivity, Lefty speeded up his work, grinding a bearing every 12 seconds instead of 14. Returning from the lavatory later, he found the word rat written on the side of his lathe. The belt was cut. By the time he found a new belt in the equipment bin, a horn sounded. The line had stopped. "What the hell's the matter with you?" the foreman shouted at him. "Every time we shut down the line, we lose money. If it happens again, you're out. Understand?"
"Yes, sir."
"Okay, let her go."
And the line started up again. After the foreman had gone, O'Malley looked both ways and leaned over to whisper,
"Don't try to be a speed king, you understand? We all have to work faster that way."
Desdemona stayed home and cooked, without silkworms to tend or mulberry trees to pick, without neighbors to gossip with or goats to milk. My grandmother filled her time with food. While Lefty ground bearings nonstop, Desdemona built pastizio, moussaka, galactoburrico. She coated the kitchen table with flour, and using a bleached broomstick, rolled out paper-thin sheets of dough. The sheets came off her assembly line, one after another. They filled the kitchen. They covered the living room, where she'd laid bed sheets over the furniture. Desdemona went up and down the line, adding walnuts, butter, honey, spinach, cheese, adding more layers of dough, then more butter, before forging the assembled concoctions in the oven. At the Rouge, workers collapsed from heat and fatigue, while on Hurlbut, my grandmother did a double shift. She got up in the morning to fix breakfast and pack a lunch for her husband, then marinated a leg of lamb with wine and garlic. In the afternoon, she made her own sausages, spiced with fennel, and hung them over the heating pipes in the basement. At 3 o'clock, she started dinner, and only when it was cooking did she take a break, sitting at the kitchen table to consult her dream book on the meaning of her previous night's dreams. No fewer than 3 pots simmered on the stove
at all times. Occasionally, Jimmy Zizmo brought home a few of his business associates, hulking men with thick ham-like heads stuffed into their fedoras. Desdemona served them meals at all hours of the day. Then they were off again into the city. Desdemona cleaned up. The only thing she refused to do was the shopping. American stores confused her. She found the produce depressing. Even many years later, seeing a Kroger's Macintosh in our suburban kitchen, she would hold it up to ridicule, say, "This is nothing. This we feed to goats." To step into a local market was to miss the savor of the peaches, figs, and winter chestnuts of Bursa. Already in her first months in America, Desdemona was suffering the homesickness that has no cure. So after working at the plant and attending English class, Lefty was the one to pick up the lamb and vegetables, the spices and honey. And so they lived 1 month, 3, 5. They suffered through their first Michigan winter. A January night, just past 1 a.m., Desdemona Stefanides, asleep, wearing her hated YMCA hat against the wind blowing through the thin walls, a radiator sighing, clanking. By candlelight, Lefty finishes his homework, notebook propped on knees, pencil in hand, and from the wall, rustling, he looks up to see a pair of red eyes shining out from a hole in the baseboard. He writes, R-A-T, before throwing his pencil at the vermin. Desdemona sleeps on. He brushes her hair. He says, in English, "Hello, sweetheart." The new country and its language have helped to push the past a little further behind. The sleeping form next to him is less and less his sister every night and more his wife. The statute of limitations ticks itself out day by day, all memory of the crime being washed away. But what humans forget, cells remember. The body, that elephant. Spring arrived, 1923. My grandfather, accustomed to the multifarious conjugations of ancient Greek verbs, had found English, for all its incoherence, a relatively simple tongue to master. Once he had swallowed a good portion of the English vocabulary, he began to taste the familiar ingredients, the Greek seasoning in the roots, prefixes, and suffixes. A pageant was planned to celebrate the Ford English School graduation, as a top student, Lefty, was asked to take part. "What kind of pageant?" Desdemona asked. "I can't tell you. It's a surprise, but you have to sew me some clothes." "What kind?" "Like from the Patrida." It was a Wednesday evening. Lefty and Zizmo were in the sala when suddenly Lena came in to listen to the Ronnie Ronette Hour. Zizmo gave her a disapproving look, but she escaped behind her headphones.
"She thinks she's one of these Americanities," Zizmo said to Lefty. "Look, see, she even crosses her legs."
"This is America," Lefty said. "We're all Americanities now."
"This is not America," Zizmo countered. "This is my house. We don't live like the Americanities in here. Your wife understands. Do you see her in the sala showing her legs and listening to radio?"
Someone knocked at the door. Zizmo, who had an inexplicable aversion to unannounced guests, jumped up and reached under his coat. He motioned for Lefty not to move. Lena, noticing something, took off her earphones. The knock came again. "Kiri," Lena said, "if they were going to kill you, would they not?"
"Who's going to kill?"
Desdemona said, rushing in from the kitchen.
"Just a way of speaking," said Lena, who knew more about her husband's importing concern than she'd been letting on. She glided to the door and opened it. Two men stood on the welcome mat. They wore gray suits, striped ties, black brogues. They had short sideburns. They carried matching briefcases. When they removed their hats, they revealed identical chestnut hair, neatly parted in the center. Zizmo took his hand out of his coat.
"We're from the Ford Sociological Department," the tall one said. "Is Mr. Stefanides at home?"
"Yes,"
Lefty said. Mr. Stephanides, let me tell you why we're here. Management has foreseen, the short one seamlessly continued, that $5 a day in the hands of some men might work a tremendous handicap along the paths of rectitude and right living, and might make of them a menace to society in general. So it was established by Mr. Ford, the taller one again took over, that no man is to receive the money who cannot use it advisedly and conservatively. Also, the short one again, that where a man seems to qualify under the plan and later develops weaknesses, that it is within the province of the company to take away his share of the profits until such time as he can rehabilitate himself. May we come in?
Once across the threshold, they separated. The tall one took a pad from his briefcase.
I'm going to ask you a few questions, if you don't mind. Do you drink, Mr. Stephanides?
No, he doesn't, Zizmo answered for him.
And who are you, may I ask? My name is Zizmo. Are you a boarder here? This is my house. So, Mr. and Mrs. Stephanides are the boarders.
That's right.